Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Now, Christopher Buckley became managing editor of Esquire magazine at age 24. At age 20, he told me to break a leg, by the way, so I'm out here. At age 29, he became chief speechwriter to the Vice President of the United States, George H.W. Bush. Since 1989, he has been founder and editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine. Mr. Buckley is the author of 12 books, most of them national bestsellers. They include The White House Mess, Wet Work, Thank You for Smoking, God is My Broker, Little Green Men, No Way to Treat a First Lady, and Florence of Arabia. His latest book, Losing Mum and Pup, which he will discuss tonight, is a tragicomic true story of the year in which both of his parents died. Mr. Buckley's journalism, satire, and criticism have been widely published in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New Republic, and Vanity Fair, Esquire, and other productions. Gregory Rodriguez, director of the California Fellows Program, they changed this on me, and an op-ed columnist at the Los Angeles Times, will be our coordinator this evening for this event. So, please join me in welcoming Christopher Buckley and Gregory Rodriguez.
I'm Gregory Rodriguez.
And you're not. So you've been doing a lot of these.
Well, I've been on, can you hear me okay? I've been on a book tour, and I may make no sense tonight.
You didn't in the green room at all, by the way.
They're curious things, book tours. I've written, I guess, a little over a dozen books, and after the seventh or eighth book, I became sort of bored with the about the author paragraph, you know, on the back flap. The paragraph that authors pretend they didn't write. You know, the ones that begin, you know, considered one of the leading voices of his generation. Oh, no, I didn't write that. So I started just making them up. And for this particular one, I put that he has been an advisor to every American president since William Howard Taft. And I was on about day 10 of the book tour. Today I'm on about day 11, so brace yourself. And I was going into a radio interview in Boston. It was a drive time AM radio interview. There's a hierarchy of those things. You know, up here you have NPR and All Things Considered and Terry Gross, where they actually like read your book or at least know something about it. And then down about here you have the AM drive time guys. And so I walked into the studio and the host, to use a generous term, was hunched over the about the author paragraph, sort of speed reading it with beetled brow. And I walked in and he looked up and he said, "You were an advisor to William Howard Taft?" And this was just too good to pass up. And I said, "Yeah. Yeah." And he said, "Well, so we could talk about that?" I said, "Sure." So we did. And I haven't been invited back on, but it was you know, it was worth it.
Plus, so, you just screwed up my first question. What I found really amazing about the book was that you're really you're this is a fine line that you don't want to cross and you don't want to go too far. You're grieving, and you were grieving as you wrote it, and yet you're trying to be funny. You were to some extent trying to reveal things about your parents, and yet you were trying to be respectful. It seems to me that I imagine you writing this book and the energy it took knowing what not to say at any given point. I mean, was this, could you take us through that process of not wanting to reveal too much, and yet was that a difficult process?
Well, I took a few things out of the first draft, you know, after circulating it to a select few, it came back with, you know, certain paragraphs circled and said, no. I write comic novels basically, and this is not a comic novel. This is a book about the death of my parents, an experience that is universal. And I hadn't planned to write it. I just sat down one day and started writing it, and wrote it. It just sort of poured out, and I wrote it in 40 days. There's no biblical allusion intended there, although it was kind of crowded inside that boat with all those animals. But you know, being a comic novelist, I guess that part of it, I mean, sort of bubbled out perforce. There are moments in this, in this awful experience that present themselves, perhaps comically. I found myself in the funeral home after my mother died with my father, and I'm sure some of you, to judge from the color of your hair, have been in this situation. But there you are. You're in the funeral home with your father, and he was trying not to lose it. He said to me, "No me digas nada triste." You know, we spoke Spanish, which means "Don't say anything sad to me." He was afraid of losing it. So there you are in this funeral home, in the conference room, with all the displays on the wall, and there, you know, what kind of urns you can get, and this being America, there's a wide variety. And you could even get a little pendant. That you could wear around your neck with mom's ashes, or, you know, which would make for a heck of a conversation starter on a first date. You know. Who's this? This is mother. Alfred Hitchcock could make a movie out of it. So there you are, and the guy, you know, the funeral director, they talk like this, and then, "I'm so sorry for your loss." You know. Meanwhile, he's not at all sorry for your loss. See, this is not a loss for him. This is big bucks. And so, you know, we came just to arrange for mom's cremation. She wanted to be cremated. And so, you know, this ought to be a simple thing, right? But no, he slides this list across, you know, and it's got 27 items on it. And it's, how many steps are there in the cremation here? And said, "Well, there's, you know, the transportation from the hospital to the funeral home. Then there's refrigeration. That's $600. And, you know, 15 minutes into this, I was thinking, you know, is he going to lean over and say, "Now, would you prefer propane?" Mesquite? Or charcoal, that's very attractive. And so, you know, my dad's trying not to lose it. And I'm not, this is not a laugh riot at the time. It's sort of funny now. But so he goes off to tabulate it all. And you hear this loud ka-ching, you know. And he comes back, and it's to cremate mom, it's $6,007. And I loved the $7, you know. Thought, you know, what's that for? Matches? You know? Now, a year later, do you take American Express? You know, I can get points. I can get, you know, like. A year later, I was in Maine, where we go in the summers, and my great friend Rust Hills died, and he was staying in the next town, a town called Belfast, Maine. He was a great literary editor of Esquire, and so I went over the next day to help his widow and daughter with the with the funeral home. I said, "Leave this to me. You know, I can so do this." And so we went to the funeral home in Belfast, Maine, and I was, you know, my loins were girded, you know. And it's Maine. And he said, "Well, that'll be $800. You know? I said, "That's it?" He said, "Yeah, is that too much?" No, it's fine. So I called my wife after. I said, "When I start to fail, get me to Belfast." this is... So, you know, it's not funny, but it's also funny.
I mean, lest anyone think that this is all fun and games. I mean, there's some really poignant, I was teary-eyed as I finished this book on a flight back from New Orleans to Los Angeles. It's a moving book, and I have not suffered the loss of my parents as of yet, thank goodness. But you also have these amazing, powerful moments. If I may just bring one up, and there's a moment at which you, at one point later, sort of wonder whether it was just a presumption on your part, at which you're at your mother's deathbed, and you say, "I forgive you." And this is an extraordinarily powerful thing to write, and we don't know for what, really, on some level, but why did you feel a need to, I mean, this is all part of writing it, but why tell us that?
A memoir has to be honest. That happens.
That's actually not true, is it? How many memoirs do you know that are
honest?
Well,
not if it's James Fry. A Million Little Pieces. The Oprah guy.
Don't change the subject.
I'll tell you about that moment. I was. I drove 8 hours through a driving storm to reach my mother's deathbed. You know, she was in a coma. I got there, and you walk in, and no matter how prepared you are for this, I knew it was coming. It hits you hot, hard, and unrehearsed. And I sat there holding her hand. Those words just came out, and I say in the book, they sound terribly presumptuous, but Mom, bless her heart, you know, she was a great lady, you know, I loved her deeply, but she could be absolutely impossible, you know, and she did some very naughty things, you know, and she was very proud, and she never, my father was deeply Catholic, and, you know, I mean, went to confession, and you know, so you don't have to say he didn't need me to forgive him. And I should point out that at my deathbed, I hope someone says to me, "I forgive you." But anyway, I said it because I just, you know, my wife has a rule: don't go to bed angry. You know, and I didn't. I was sending her off to bed, and I didn't want any anger. And I probably said it more for myself than for her. So it just came out, but it was a real moment. She was an extraordinary woman, my mother. It was Pat Buckley. She was a Vancouver, British Columbia debutante, you know, who married this unlikely guy, William F. Buckley. And she goes from being a Vancouver debutante to being the wife of a junior faculty member in the Spanish department. But my dad taught Spanish while he wrote God and Man at Yale. And she went from being this sort of orchid to wearing a hairnet with a cigarette and and vacuuming, and which must have been a funny sight, because we knew her, the world knew her as the chic and stunning Mrs. Buckley, as Woman's Wear Daily used to call her, and she had never, I don't think she'd ever boiled water. And so, but she dutifully took the train into New York 3 times a week to take cooking classes from a man named James Beard. Who was, and she ended up being a great cook. But she was really an improbable character. She was something out of Noel Coward. I'm going to do a Henry Kissinger imitation, because this was something he said at her memorial service. He said, Pat Buckley used to say, I'm just a simple girl from the backwoods of British Columbia. Well, if Pat Buckley is a simple girl from the backwoods of British Columbia, I would tremble to meet a sophisticated girl. But she was, she was quite something. Anyway, that's.
You describe her as theatrical. You describe her as on occasion of given to exaggeration. And I wonder if you could share some of those exaggerations.
Well, I remember age six being allowed to sit at the grown-ups table or whatever, and I heard her say, oh, when the king and queen were in Vancouver, they always stayed with us. And I thought, I used to spend a lot of time in Vancouver with my grandparents. I never heard them mention this, that the king and queen were. And I realized this was a complete fabrication, but I found it thrilling. And it started me off on a lifetime of mendacity, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. But I looked on it as she could tell these whoppers, but I look back on it now as almost a kind of an art form. You know, it was a way, I think, of just improving a story.
Right.
Maybe this is why I write fiction. You know, fiction is basically just one lie after another. But sometimes it was funny and sometimes it wasn't so funny, but she was quite something.
How did your father deal with these white lies and the not so white lies? How did you react to this? Were there moments in which you said, "Mom, come on"? Or are there moments? Did he just close his mouth and go with it? What was the family strategy?
Well, drugs. when she was in, her shtick, if you call it that, also took the form of she would say things with she was perfectly capable of interrupting Henry Kissinger in the middle of in mid paragraph to inform him that he knew absolutely nothing about the Middle East, and she had such authority that even Henry Kissinger would sort of stare into his borscht, and while someone changed the subject. But it was funny sometimes, and other times it was you really wanted to be somewhere else. It was not Ozzie and Harriet,
And in the writing on the process of grieving for your parents and writing about your life with your parents, clearly people like Henry Kissinger just pop up, and I wondered if you might want to tell some stories of who might have just shown up at your house one any given day.
Well, they knew sort of everyone, but there were some funny funny little moments. One time, and it was summer, and we were having lunch on the terrace in Stamford, Connecticut, where they lived, and a car drove up, and my dad said, "I wonder who that could be," and a tall, very almost movie star handsome man approached down the terrace, and my parents sort of peered, and they both cried out almost in unison, "Charlie!" And it turned out to be a guy named Charlie Blair. My folks rented the apartment over the garage to, help pay the taxes and stuff. And for years they rented it to this guy, Charlie Blair, who was then the top pilot for Pan Am. But he had a job on the side, which was training Gary Francis Powers to fly the U-2. Not quite well enough.
No one was actually going to say that to you. But.
So Charlie sat down and had iced tea, and they were you know, we chatted for half an hour or so, and it was, I remember it was quite warm. And at one point, my dad said, "How's Maureen?" And Charlie, along the line, had married Maureen O'Hara. And he said, "Oh, fine, she's in the car." And I remember the look on my mother's face. She said, "Do you mean to tell me this entire time she's been in the car?" It was almost as if, you know, did you roll the window down? And he said, "Well, for heaven's sakes, bring her in." He said, "Oh no, she'll be fine." You know, and he acted as though, you know, bringing Maureen O'Hara in for a glass of iced tea would be an intolerable imposition. Anyway, he was prevailed upon, and that's how I met Maureen O'Hara.
That was just one of the little moments. Well, that's one of the delightful things about the book, is in this, there's a very serious, he's talking about something very serious, but then it's populated by all these characters, and there's moments of you talking to Governor Reagan at the, when you were, how old were you?
Well, in 1966, Pop had started Firing Line, his TV show, which would run for 33 years. I think it holds the record for longest single host of a TV show. And I was 14, and I accompanied him to California, where he was going to tape a series of shows, one with Robert Vaughn, the man from Uncle, and the other was with the newly minted Governor Ronald Reagan. And I confess that I was much more excited about the Robert Vaughn taping. But we went on to Sacramento, and we stayed with the Reagans, and they gave a cocktail party for my dad, and, you know, Sacramento came. And I found myself a 14-year-old boy in this garden amidst a sea of grown-ups, and it was pretty boring. So I went off and sort of sat on a rock, feeling kind of sorry for myself. And I became aware that someone was standing next to me. I looked up, and there was Governor Reagan. You know, where he was wearing a white jacket, I remember. And he was really, really handsome. And he had just seen this lonely boy, you know, wander off into the garden and had gone over to keep him company. This was a gesture that I never forgot, you know. So sort of a sweet moment.
Having met, I mean, grown up with so many really well accomplished people, you say twice in the book that you believe your father was a great man.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could describe what is greatness and why was your father a great man?
Well, he did a lot, you know. He started in 1955, the conservative movement was even worse off than it is today. Hard as that may be to believe. And he founded the modern conservative movement. He started a magazine against all odds. He raised the money. He got, you know, people like Whitaker Chambers, Clare Booth Luce, Evelyn Waugh to write for it. In 1961, he started a syndicated column thrice weekly, and over the years wrote 6,000 columns. In 1965, he ran for mayor of New York, sort of on a lark, but also not on a lark. Now, probably the most famous thing he ever said was at the press conference when he announced that he was running, and they said, "Well, what, Mr. Buckley, what if you win? What will you do if you win?" And he said, "Demand a recount." You know, this was back when politics was really sort of genuinely funny. In 1966, a year later, he started Firing Line, which created, you know, which was set the gold standard for intelligent discussion. He had everyone on. And he treated everyone with civility, no matter where they were on the political spectrum. All you had to do was present your arguments, or he would castrate you. But he would do it.
That brings us to our next subject.
He would do it in a, you know, in a. You saw the program. Then, along the way, he wrote, managed to knock out a book every year. Then he started writing sailing books and spy novels. He wrote 55 books. His columns, if they were collected in book form, would total 45 volumes, which gives him a total book-length output of 100 books, thousands of magazine articles. And, he changed the time he lived in. And when he died, I was, when it's up close, it's your dad, I always knew he was a significant figure, but he was also my dad, so it's you don't spend the whole time thinking my dad is significant. You more or less spend your time thinking my dad is impossible. But when he died, it was, you heard about it. It was a big deal. The President of the United States called me within an hour of his death being announced. There was an outpouring, and I think there was a sense that something, a great man had passed.
But you describe, but more than his output, you describe a quality of fearlessness that made this greatness, and mm-hmm. and fearlessness, and you also tend to describe it sometimes as recklessness, and you also describe it as this insistence and someone you can't say no to. And tell us about the greatness, and not just in terms of product
I'll
outcome.
I'll give you. He loved to sail. This was his passion, and he had a 36-foot sloop, that he kept in Stamford, and we would go out on Friday night sails, and we would sail across Long Island Sound, drop anchor, have a cocktail, barbecue, sail back the next morning. He had arranged for a sail in October. This was 1997. And so I took the train up from Washington, where I live, and I was, as the train made its way north, I was looking out the window and saying, God, the trees are kind of bent over. and sort of loose bits of things were being lofted into the air. By the time I got to Stamford, it looked like the tornado scene in The Wizard of Oz. And the train pulled in, and my dad was waiting for me on the platform, which always, sort of gave me a little lump on my throat. But I noticed this time he was like holding on to a something. And I thought, gosh, his pup injured himself? Is he leaning on? So the doors open, that psh, like that. And I was blown back by this gust of wind that must have been about 50 miles an hour. So I crawled out of the train practically on all fours. And he says, I look off at him, and he's holding on to, and he says, well, we'll have a brisk sail. And I said, we're going out in this? He said, sure, why not? So we did. And there was another guy with us. There were four of us. And this guy, a guy named Laurie Chickering from California, had never been on a sailboat before.
And never again.
And he said to me, should I take a seasick pill? And I said, no, you'll be too sick. You'll be too scared to get sick. So we went out into this. It was a northeast gale. This is a technical term, a northeast gale. Some of you have probably heard of it. I don't think you have them on this coast, but you have other things like earthquakes today. Right? It was, have you seen the movie The Perfect Storm? The old Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Long Island, the governors declared a state of emergency. There was no power. Suddenly, I saw the entire Connecticut coastline go dark. Just to make my happiness complete, and 15-foot seas, and but this was sort of a piece, weirdly, with his greatness. Now, to be sure, it was also incredibly reckless. But, you know, great men, they have their own standards, and they always have too much sail up. You know, great men always have too much canvas up. Those of you who sail, you know, if the storm is coming, you shorten sail. I sailed across three oceans with Pop. And whenever a storm came, you know, he said, let's put up the spinnaker. You know, no. It's like in the movie, no. But we had some adventurous moments.
So in instances, stories like this, you talk about how you couldn't convince him otherwise, and you go along with it. And,
no.
And yet it sounds like you describe him, I think, consistently as someone you just can't say no to. And yet, so perhaps you picked bigger battles, and one of the tensions that you describe in the book is that over Catholicism. So you picked a big battle, and your father was a devout Catholic, and you are not. And this is a theme. At what age did that start? And could you take us through that sort of the theological tensions with Dad?
Well, Pop was a very, very devout Catholic. He never doubted. He was that rarity. He was a man who never questioned his faith. His mother was a very devout woman from New Orleans. And Pop's father, William Frank Buckley Sr., was from Texas. And his father was a sheriff whose best friend was Pat Garrett, the man who shot Billy the Kid. So he grew up with these two very, very, very religious parents, and he did his best to make me that. I was sent off at age 13 to the monks of Portsmouth Priory, and it didn't take. I mean, I think I've paid my dues. 4 years at a monastery is pretty good dues. And, you know, at a certain point you reach your own conclusions. But he, this pained him because believed that if you did not believe, the gates of heaven were not open to you. And this was and I remember one time where this really hit me. It was 1980 and we were, his great friend Harry Elmlark had died. Harry was, as you might have guessed by his last name, Jewish. And but he was a beloved friend. He was Pop's column syndicator. And we buried we scattered Harry's ashes off the jetty. And we were walking up to the house, and Pop said to me in Spanish, because this was our sort of secret language, he said, ojalá que hubiera sido un católico, which means if only he had been Catholic. And I went, well, what do you mean by that? And it was that, you know, he explained that he did not, much as he loved Harry, he could not expect to see Harry in the next life because he was not a believer. And this made it real to him. I thought, you've got to be kidding, right? And some years later, the Catholic Church can be rigid, Lord knows, but at times, Mother Church thinks like a $700 an hour lawyer. And somewhere along the line, Mother Church came up with the doctrine of invincible ignorance, which, if I understand it correctly, is sort of a pass. You can be Jewish, Hindu, Zoroastrian, whatever, and if you were simply incapable of grasping that Jesus Christ and the Catholic Church are the one true faith, and you're not Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin, it's a way around. And he showed up and announced that he just learned about this. And he was just so happy, because this meant that people like Harry, you know, could get into heaven. And he was a profoundly good man, Pop. At the one of his great friends was a guy named Richard Klerman, who was Jewish. And Pop gave a eulogy at the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. And I remember the last line of his eulogy. Because Dick Klerman was a profoundly good man. And Pop said, it occurs to me all my life I have been searching for the perfect Christian. And when I found him, he turned out to be a non-observant Jew. You know, so he was.
Upon his death, you were respectful of his faith,
and you. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Your mother was not a devout Catholic.
No. and she was not even a devout Episcopalian. And that's pretty non-devout.
So, after they had both died, how did you reconcile and respect both of their faiths or lack thereof?
The plan was Pop at some point commissioned a Connecticut sculptor, to make a beautiful 6-foot-high bronze crucifix. It was really a stunning piece of art, and he put that in Mum's rose garden, which did not please her. And the plan was that after they were both gone, their ashes would go inside the cross and be there for all eternity, which presented me with a logistical problem. But Mum would, whenever this subject came up at the dinner table, Mum would say, would hiss at me and say, "Just send me out with the tide or the garbage. I most certainly do not wish to be inside that object." But she went first. So that was that. She went into the cross. So, sorry, Mum. You lose. But then in a couple of months before Pop died, he was failing. I was taking care of him. And I knew I was going to... See, I had this problem because his fantasy was that I would hold on to the house. And so the cross would remain. But I knew I wasn't going to be able to afford to hold on to the house. But I didn't want to sort of vex him with this logistical problem in the last months of his life. But I had to, at some point it had to be sort of broached. So we were having martinis one night, and I tiptoed into this minefield. I said, "Pop, I know you want your ashes to be in the cross." And he said, "I absolutely want them to be in the cross." I said, "Yeah." I said, "I was just wondering if, I had to sell the house ever." And he said, "Your point being?" I said, "Well, like a new owner might not want the cross, And he said, "Why not?" I said, "Well, I don't know, might be Jewish, might not want a 6-foot-high crucifix in the garden." He said, "Well, it's a work of art." I said, "Yeah, it is definitely that." So that was the end of that conversation. So Pop, 2 months later, Pop died. And so I had this, what do you do? And so I came up with a solution to bury him in Sharon, Connecticut, which is where he'd grown up, and to bury him bodily. I'm Irish, and we kind of like the body, to have one last drink around, to wake the body. And so I took Mum's ashes out of the cross. I could hear her going, "Ah." It was like getting her out of a corset, And I put her in a red lacquer Chinese box that I bought her for a birthday. And I opened up Pop's coffin and put her on his lap. And I also put in a jar of peanut butter, because he loved peanut butter, and the TV remote control. Private joke. And a rosary. And I said in the eulogy that no pharaoh ever went off into the afterlife better equipped. So I hope he will forgive me screwing up his last wishes, but I think it was in the end well done.
You just said earlier that you didn't grow up thinking, "Oh, my father is significant," and yet you struggle clearly, as any child of a man you've described as great as coming of getting out of his shadow, and you've told some amazing moment. This amazing moment of of your book that you've considered your you considered your best, and your father emailing you his critique of that book. And,
oh yeah.
And as a writer, I almost cried then. So so if you could share that with the audience.
Well, it was a book. It was two novels ago. It was a book called Boomsday. And it was getting pretty good reviews, you know. They're saying, oh, you know, this is a really good book. And I sent it to him, and I sort of, you know, waited. A week went by, 2 weeks went by, 3 weeks went by. Now you're kind of pissed off. And finally I got an email from him about something else, and there was a P.S. He said, this one didn't work for me. Sorry.
Ouch.
Well, yeah, you kind of, I was kind of hoping for something more, you know. But that was, he could also be generous with his praise. But he was a tough grader, and if he, but I couldn't quite account for it. Maybe he was just in a bad mood that day. But, you know, it's funny now. It wasn't quite so, it actually wasn't really funny at the time. Actually, I kind of hated him.
So, I mean, not to get back to your father's writing life, one more question. The moment, he's near death at this point when he's writing the Goldwater book, mm-hmm. right? And he's breathing, he's on an oxygen machine.
Yeah, he had emphysema.
He's not really up to being at his computer.
He went from being one of the most agile, fast touch typists in the history of touch typing to sending out emails. He would just, in the end, just put his fingers down on the keyboard wherever and start typing. So you would get these emails that read like military codes. Really, you needed an Enigma machine to. And anyway, he was toward the end. He was working on a memoir about his friendship with Barry Goldwater, and he could barely move. He could barely breathe. He got him over to the. It was pouring rain, and his study was in the garage, which was about 150 feet from the house. I got him over there. We get in. To the study, we're drenched to the skin, and he wants to work on his book, which I thought valiant, but he was in very rough shape, and I put him down in front of the keyboard, and he leaned over and he said, "You're going to have to take dictation." Well, he was still using a word processing program called WordStar, which was the word processing system he learned in 1983. And he just refused to learn anything else. I would tell him, try Macintosh, you know, they were amazing. No, he wouldn't hear of it. So his successive computer gurus would have to load WordStar into increasingly fast computers, which was like putting the controls of a Sopwith Camel into an F-16, you know? But he wouldn't budge off WordStar. So I had to take dictation on WordStar, which I felt like, you know, I was operating a diesel submarine, you know, like, you know, quotation marks coming up, you know, hit the pedal and press six keys. So, but he started dictating the last chapter of the epilogue of his Barry Goldwater book, and it came out perfectly. It was as if his mind was a still burning fire trapped inside the wreckage of his body. And it was flawless. And I was amazed. I managed to get it down in word stories. And then he said, all right, let's print it. And he came over and pressed something. Yeah. And he said, where is it? I said, I don't know. So he'd erased it. And he said, well, we'll have to do it again. And so I said, I'll take dictation, but on my Macintosh this time. But so I went and got the Macintosh, and he dictated again, almost verbatim. And I was, as I say, I think when I got to the end of it, I was for the 1,000th time in my life in awe of William F. Buckley. Yeah.
You mentioned receiving a call from the president upon the death of your father, and you take a considerable amount of time telling us about the condolences. They seem to have been a significant part of your process of healing, and who called you and who wrote you and who did not. First of all, why is that important?
Well, my friend Monty Begley she's Irish, and she says, you know, you never remember who came to the funeral, but you never forget who didn't. It was quite an outpouring. I was a little, everyone.
But who surprised you?
One of the first calls was from John Kerry, Senator John Kerry, who... He didn't owe. When my mom died, I got a handwritten note from Al Gore. I was surprised that we never heard from John McCain. William F. Buckley dies. Okay, he's the founder of the movement that you're currently running for president from within. And I know there was a presidential campaign on, but it takes 5 minutes to make a phone call, or 3 minutes to write an email. It struck me as, looking back, this is not why I endorsed Barack Obama, by the way, but it struck me as uncool and sloppy, and stupid, by the way. The President of the United States has time to call you. This Pop's death was announced from the White House, But let me tell you who did call. I was, about a month later, it was a few days before Pop's memorial service at St. Patrick's, which was a big deal, a lot of planning. And the phone rings, and I heard this sort of sandpapery voice saying, "Hi, I'm looking for Christopher Buckley." And I said, this is he. And he said, "Oh, Chris, it's George McGovern." And whom I'd never met, but he and Pup had become friends in the course of, they did debates together. And I remember it was about 10 years before. And I remember Pup one day at the lunch table, he had this gleam in his eye. He said, "Say, have I told you who my new best friend is?" And we said, "Who?" He said, "George McGovern." He said, "He turns out to be the single nicest human being I've ever met." Yeah. And my jaw dropped, not because I thought George McGovern was a bad man, but because he couldn't have been more opposite politically. But Pup had great friendships on the left. John Kenneth Galbraith, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Al Lowenstein, Ira Glasser, the ACLU, Murray Kempton, they were all very, very close friends. And George McGovern said, he was calling to say that he was going to come to the memorial service. He was going to do everything he could to come to the memorial service. He had cancer, and he said, "If I can get out from under this 15-foot-high snowdrift," he was calling from South Dakota, and I hung up the phone and I cried, it was a... It was, so amazing, We need more of that, now.
I'm hoping to round out the hour. You could read some of your book.
I'll just read you. Well, this is a bit of my eulogy at St. Patrick's. He had said to me, "If I'm still famous, do it at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York." He said, "If I'm not, just do it at St. Mary's in Stamford." And I stood up there. It was a packed house, 2,200 people, and I told that story, and I said, well, Pop, I guess you're still famous. Everyone laughed. I took the podium and said, Pope Benedict will be saying Mass here in 2 weeks. I was told that the music at this Mass for my father would, in effect, be the dress rehearsal for the Pope's. I think that would have pleased him, though doubtless he'd have preferred it to be the other way around. On the day he retired from firing line after a 33-year long run, Nightline did a show to mark the occasion. At the end, Ted Koppel said, Bill, we have 1 minute left. Would you care to sum up your 33 years in television? To which my father replied, no. Taking that cue, I won't attempt to sum him up in my few minutes up here. Jose Marti famously said that a man must do 3 things in life, write a book, plant a tree, have a son. I don't know that my father ever planted a tree. Surely whole forests, enough to make Al Gore weep, were put to the axe on his account. But he did plant a great many seeds, and many of them grown to fruition are here today. Quite a harvest, that. It's not easy coming up with an epitaph for such a man. I was tempted by something Mark Twain once said. Homer's dead, Shakespeare's dead, and I myself am not feeling at all well. Years ago, he gave an interview to Playboy magazine. Asked why he did this, he couldn't resist saying, in order to communicate with my 16-year-old son. At the end of the interview, he was asked what he would like for an epitaph, and he replied, I know that my Redeemer liveth. Only Pup could manage to work the Book of Job into a Hugh Hefner publication. I finally settled on one, and I'll say the words over his grave at sunset in Sharon when I lay him to rest this afternoon. They're from a poem he knew well, each line of which, indeed, seems to have been written just for him. Under the wide and starry sky, let me live and let me die. Dig the grave and let me lie. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will. This be the grave, this be the verse you grave for me. Here he lies where he longed to be. Home is the hunter, home is the sailor, home from sea, and the hunter home from the hill.
Chris Buckley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take some sort of questions from the audience, and if you could raise your hand, and the microphone's here. Yes, but you have the mic. Very good. Ma'am, please.
You were wonderful, but where is the cross now?
over his and Mom's grave in Sharon. I'm tempted to say that I sold it. And got a good price, too. You know, the price of bronze has gone up. No, it's in Sharon, right? Looking over them.
Well, since you're in the section already.
You've talked an awful lot about your dad. Would you like to spend a few minutes talking about your mom and what she did?
We talked about her, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, actually, why don't you tell us about the preparations for your mother's, the sending off your mother and how much work you did and who was there to say goodbye to your mom after she passed, the funeral.
Well, arranged Mom's memorial service, which was, she had done a lot of work for the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum, and so I I thought, well, let's try that. So I called, and they were very generous and offered the Temple of Dendur. You've seen it, which is a really cool space. So I found myself planning a memorial service for a woman who excelled at, you know, the party, the event preparation. And I said in the book, you know, all my life, I suppose, unconsciously, I've been trying to, you know, live up to my father, and I found myself now trying to live up to my mother, which was even more daunting, since it's event planning. But I did it, and all I pretty much had to say was, "What would, if anyone asked a question, I said, what would Pat do?" You know, they said, "Oh, fine, well." And so we gave her a grand send off at the Temple of Dendur, and which is. My dad, you know, it took a month. I now feel I could, with confidence, produce a wedding. So the day of the morning of the memorial service, it looked just fantastic. The flowers, the programs, the caterers, this everything. You know, the audio visual. My dad walked in, and I had this sort of. And he looked up and he kind of squinted and said, "It's awfully bright, isn't it?" He was used to seeing it at night. I was tempted to throw him into the pool, you know, but it ended up being quite a good event.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Anyone over here has a question?
There's a lady in the front here.
You described your father in a lot of ways as sort of a monumental narcissist. Do you feel that the collapse of his movement is somehow, what do you think he'd say if he saw what has happened in the last 2 years?
Well, he was a lot, did you all hear that question? Yeah. He only died in last February, so he was pretty much aware that the conservative movement was not in very good shape. And he was, and someone asked him about that, and they said, you know, what do you, and he dealt with it he used a word that only WFB would use. He said that he thought the conservative movement was in need of repristination. which I think is a pretty good way of putting it. You know, he I think he was disappointed, but he didn't die a saddened man. I mean, he won his battles. You know, he started a movement that ultimately put Ronald Reagan in the presidency. And that was the arc of it. And American politics has those arcs. Our history is marked by cycles. And he outlived the success of his cycle by a little bit. But he died in that sense, I think, a fulfilled man. He was not in any way bitter. But he was disappointed. He pronounced in 2004, I think it was, he wrote a column declaring that the Iraq adventure was a failure and that in a British parliamentary system, Bush would have had to resign. And I was struck by how much notice that declaration of his got. It told me that he still had mojo, and it was almost faute de mieux, as he would say, like Walter Cronkite after the Tet Offensive, saying, you know, that we're not going to win this thing. And, you know, Lyndon Johnson saying, you know, we've lost Walter. And there was a sense of, you know, I think we've lost Buckley. But I think he was very disappointed in what the Republican Party had turned into.
Right in front of you.
This lady in the black with the white trim has held her hand up for...
At what stage of your own intellectual development did you form somewhat different ideas from your famous father? ideas about the world and...
Well, I haven't had much intellectual development. It's a work in progress, you might say. If you're talking politically, I used to be a pretty right wing, and I'm less so. And I would consider myself sort of post ideological. Ideology doesn't interest me so much anymore. I'm more sort of solution oriented. If you will, and Pop was, although he was conservative, he took many unpredictable positions. He was for the decriminalization of drugs as early as the 1970s. He wasn't particularly doctrinaire, he had a supple mind, but on certain things he was. Absolutely adamant and convinced, especially with respect to religion. And I think his Catholic faith anchored his political philosophy. If you believe profoundly in a faith, I think that has to influence the way your brain absorbs the world in a political way.
We have time for one more question. I'm gonna let you choose who gets to ask the last question.
Oh, how exciting!
There you go.
Just hold up dollar bills, and I'll pick whoever holds up the. Okay, how can I resist this lady in blue here?
Your mother and father died within a year of each other, right? Was that a surprise to you? I mean, was your father failing as your mother was failing, and was it? Had you expected, perhaps had an expectation that your father might live a little bit longer?
He had emphysema, which is a very cruel disease. The irony was that he had, when I was 16 and he found out that I was smoking cigarettes, he sent me a letter at boarding school threatening not to give his permission for me to get my driver's license. And then he dies of emphysema. He smoked cigars, and unlike a certain former president, inhaled. He wanted to die. When my mother, after my mother died, he kind of had. This is not uncommon, you know. They were married for 50. They were married the day Elizabeth Taylor was married for the first time. Yeah, July 6th, 1950. He was sort of tickled by that. He was, after she went, he just, you know, he didn't want to go on, and I didn't want him to go on. He was suffering, and it was, you know, we would have these veiled conversations about suicide. You know, I wanted. You know, if he had moved that finger, I would have, you know, crushed sleeping pills into yogurt. But I didn't want to go to jail. You know, but he wasn't quite. He thought about suicide and actually talked to some priests about it, and talked to two priests, and they apparently told him that it would be a sin. But it would be a forgivable sin. See, this is where Mother Church is the $700 an hour lawyer. You know? Now we think there's a way. But you know, it's hard to watch someone once so vital disintegrate. But in the end, you know, he died at his desk. He went out to work on his book, and he collapsed. And we found that he died. In the same spot where he had worked for 54 years, you know, which is not a bad way to go. I would be happy to go that way. Not just yet. Not just yet. Not until after dinner, anyway. But anyway, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud Audio. Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.